Okay, we're up to chapter 9. This is one of my favorite chapters, by the way. This is a fascinating chapter. And we're going to take our time with it. Well, we always take our time, but there's just so much fascinating. So we're up to chapter 9 in John, and in our notes, we will be beginning on page 74. And of course, this is the story of the healing of the man born blind. Fascinating story. Now, before we begin, let me just read you something from the book of Isaiah. And this is Isaiah chapter 42. You might want to turn there. Isaiah chapter 42. And we want to read starting from verse 1. Isaiah 42, and starting from verse 1. I'll wait till everybody has it so we can read it together. Isaiah 42, verse 1. Okay, I'm going to read now. I see somebody still looking for it. Take your time. I want everybody able to follow along. Okay, Isaiah 42 and verse 1. Behold. Now, by the way, before I start, in case you're not familiar, in the book of Isaiah, there are what scholars and the ancient rabbis refer to as five servant songs. And these are five passages about the servant of the Lord. And this is one of them. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will expectantly wait for his law. Thus says the Lord God, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open the eyes of the blind, to bring prisoners from the dungeon. So we see here, prophetically, that one of the things this servant, and the servant is the Messiah, would do when he came would be to open the eyes of the blind. This would be one of the ways that his Jewish people would recognize him as being the Messiah. This was one of the criteria. And this is one of the ways he would affirm his claim to be the Messiah. So when we come to the New Covenant and read it, we should expect him to be doing these kinds of things. Now, before we actually get into the chapter, let's think for a moment about this man's situation. You know, it's easy to read these stories, man born blind, and pass over this, but think about the world of a man born blind. I mean, there are people who can see, who some tragic event takes place in their life, either a disease or an accident, and they can no longer see. And that's horrible. That's horrible. But I think it's even worse to be born blind, because if you can see and then something causes you to be blind, you still have a frame of reference. You still know what people look like. You know what the world looks like. And although, again, it's tragic, I don't want to diminish the tragedy of becoming blind, But if you're born blind, you have no point. You don't even know what it means to not see. You don't even know what that means. You have no point of reference for anything. Of course, you still have your sense of feel, so that becomes your point of reference. But you live your life in the dark, which you don't even know what that means, and you don't. I mean, imagine. You get married. You don't know what your wife looks like or your husband looks like. You don't know what food looks like. You don't know what it just seems to me as though it's a dreadful state. Now, I guess on the one hand, you might be able to say, well, you don't know what you're missing. But it seems to me that it's that eyesight is so precious. To be born blind must be horrible. Now, of course, the Jewish people, and we'll see this in the notes of Yeshua's day, believed that if a person were born blind, that was the result of sin. It was the result of sin. And we'll get to that when we get to the notes, but they believed that either the parents or the grandparents had sinned, or in some way the person, him or herself, had sinned, either in the womb or sometime prior, but that it was a result of sin. So not only were you living in this world in which you could barely function, but you lived with this knowledge that the way I am is because my parents committed sin, or my grandparents, or I committed sin, not even really knowing what that sin is. So it really must have been very difficult. And think about this man born blind. All he could do was sit and beg and wait for what? For his Redeemer, hopefully one day, to come along, for his healer to come along. He probably had a hope. His hope probably diminished with time, but what else could he do? Now, when the blind do learn to see, first, let me state something before I say this. When the blind do learn to see, today in medical science, scientists can do phenomenal things. They can almost perform miracles now, and they can make the blind see in many cases, but not if they're born blind. Doctors cannot take someone who was born blind and cause them to see. They simply can't do it. Now, usually when a person is born blind, the reason they're born blind is because they were born without optic nerves. And that's the nerve that connects the eye to the brain. And without an optic nerve, you cannot see. And scientists, doctors, do not have the ability to form or make or create an optic nerve to put it in there. And so what we're going to be reading about in chapter 9, what Yeshua did, is something that we simply medically cannot do. There are other healings. Yeshua healed a number of blind people. And today it is true that doctors can, in some cases, take someone who's blind and cause them to see, but not if they're born blind. They can't do that. And if you have someone who is blind, and the doctors are able to make them see, once they make that person able to see, then that person has to learn how to see. At first, all they see is colors. They don't see shapes yet. At first, all they see is colors. And then when they start to see, all faces look the same. They can't distinguish yet. And Bob was telling me the story of a woman who was blind and given sight. And she was standing and we're looking down, and she looked at a pine cone and didn't know what it was. And said, what is this? Then she felt it and knew what it was, because she recognized by feel. That's how what she did before she had her eyesight. Now, another thing I want to mention is, and we'll get to this, we've all read the story, right, about the man born blind. And you remember how when he was, after he gain sight. People were debating, is this him? Is this the one who was born blind? No, it's not him. It's another. Oh, yes, this is him. Now, why would they have that confusion? Well, generally speaking, not generally, often when someone is born blind, and this may have been the case here, I'm not being dogmatic, but this may have been the case, they don't have eyes. And if you take someone who doesn't have eyes and give them eyes, they look completely different. You don't even recognize them at first. And this may have been the case here. This may have been why they didn't recognize him, because he may have been a man without eyes, and you just have those sockets, and then all of a sudden have eyes in them. It just changes your appearance so dramatically that at first people just don't even recognize you. So this may be what happened here. This is a very good example of people who are spiritually blind, because, as I said, a person born blind doesn't know what he doesn't see. And the same thing is true of those who are spiritually blind. They don't know what they don't see, do they? Until they're given sight. And in a very real sense, all people are born spiritually blind and need a miracle such as this in order to be able to see what they don't see in their blindness. One of the amazing things about this miracle and about all of Yeshua's miracles is that when this man who was born blind was given his sight by Yeshua, he immediately became fully functional with his eyesight. So that extends the miracle into the greater miraculous. It's like the paralytic, rise up, take your pallet and walk. Paralytics don't rise up and walk when they're healed. They have to learn to walk. They have to use those bars, you know, that they have. So it's really a tremendous, tremendous miracle. And it accompanies Yeshua's statement, I am the light of the world, which he had just, remember in the previous chapter, he stood up and said, I am the light of the world. And here he's verifying that with this miracle. Okay, that was just by way of introduction. So we're in verse 9, and we're going to take it section by section. And first, we're going to look at the first 12 verses. We'll first take the first 12 verses of chapter 9 and take a look at them. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? See, that was the belief in those days. By the way, you know where they get that from. I am a jealous God, visiting the sins of the parents to the children to the third and fourth generation. That's the verse that they used to back up their claim. And so the feeling here was this was sin being passed on. Yeshua answered, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. And we'll explain that when we get that verse, when we get into the notes, just what he's saying there. While I am in the world, I am the light in the world. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied the clay to his eyes. Now, again, this will be mentioned in the notes, but let me mention it now. Right away, now he hadn't healed the man yet, right? He had just, according to the Pharisees, broken the Sabbath. Because it was illegal on the Sabbath to make clay, it was considered work, and spitting was considered to be plowing because you were stirring up the dirt. And this was on a Sabbath day, as we'll read. So it is evidence that Yeshua did come to confront the erroneous teaching of that day. And said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sense. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore, the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, is this not the one who used to sit and beg? Others were saying, this is he. Still others were saying, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the one. And this is what I was saying. It's possible he was born without eyes and his appearance was much different now. So they were saying to him, how then were your eyes opened? He answered, the man who was called Yeshua made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. And I went away and I washed and I received my sight. They said to him, where is he? He said, I do not know. Now notice something that we'll again get to see it towards the end of the chapter. But if Yeshua walked past this man right now without saying anything, the man would not know who this is the man who healed me, would he? Because when Yeshua approached him, he couldn't see. Yeshua put the mud on his eyes and he walked away and got his sight, not in the presence of Yeshua. So he didn't know Yeshua yet, and he didn't know what Yeshua looked like. And that's going to explain something that happens at the end of the chapter. Okay? So we want to keep that in mind. Okay, let's go to the notes now. Any comments or questions so far? Healing the man born blind. Isaiah predicted that in messianic times, various signs would occur. The Messiah would open the eyes of the blind, and we read 42:7. Yeshua often healed the blind, and I have a number of examples there. This miracle in John 9 is notable because Yeshua had just proclaimed himself as the light of the world in the previous chapter. As a public demonstration of his claim, he gave sight to a man born blind. Although Yeshua healed many blind people during his public ministry, this miracle is unique in that the person was the only individual afflicted from birth. This miracle is an illustration of the miracle of salvation. When people become believers, and this is important, they do not recover from what they formerly lost, but rather receive a completely new ability to see and understand things of God. See, somebody who can see and becomes blind, if they're made to see again, they're recovering something they once had. But somebody who is blind from birth, who is made to see, is receiving something they never had. And that's a picture of salvation. Because when we become saved, we receive something we never had. It's not like we lost our salvation sometime back there, and now we're getting it back again. We're receiving something we never had to begin with. So this man is a very good illustration of salvation. For the first time in his life, this man was going to see, and one of the first images he would see would be the Son of God. Okay. The healing of the man born blind is an illustration of the progress of the conflict between Yeshua and his opponents. Remember how we keep mentioning these themes that we saw in the prologue will be developed and grow throughout the gospel? And one of the conflicts is the conflict between light and darkness, and between truth and untruth, and between acceptance and rejection of Yeshua. Well, in this chapter, we're going to see there's a great conflict that results from this happening between Yeshua and his opponents. And it's an outstanding example of development of belief and unbelief. There are those who believe and there are those who don't. The belief is exemplified in the man, the unbelief, and the reaction of the Pharisees who examined him and finally excommunicated him. This man gets excommunicated. Now, by the way, let me explain excommunication so we understand. We want to make sure we have a good handle on what that word means and what it should mean and so forth. Let me start with today. Excommunication means disfellowship, put out of fellowship. Today, in the body, when exercised properly, excommunication takes place when a person is living in sin and is put through the disciplinary process discussed in Scripture, right? Go to them, and if they repent, you have won your brother. If they don't, go with two or more witnesses. If they refuse to hear them, take them before the congregation, which really means the elders. And if they refuse to listen to the elders, let them be to you as a tax gatherer. And that final step is excommunication, being put out of the fellowship. And then as believers in the body, we should not fellowship with that person any longer. However, that takes place in 1 Corinthians 1, right? However, in 2 Corinthians, that person clearly has repented, and Paul says, bring them back into fellowship. It's like the prodigal son. So the proper use of excommunication today is the final step in discipline with the hope that the person repents and is brought back into fellowship. It's not designed to be permanent. However, in the days of the Pharisees, when you were excommunicated, you were gone. You were put out of the synagogue. You couldn't come to worship in the synagogue anymore, and no one would have anything to do with you anymore for fear of the Pharisees. Okay. Now, there's some more details about excommunication in Yeshua's day that we'll get into, but we'll get into them when we get into the notes. Because not all excommunication was necessarily permanent, but I want to hold off now. When we get into notes, we'll see a few more details about that. We know that the Catholic Church has excommunication as one of their as one of their forms of discipline, but again, they exercise it differently than biblically, if you're familiar with it. Okay. So, as we're going to see, this man eventually gets excommunicated. Notice the word, too, really does. It's a word, it's a compound word, because you start with the word communicated, right? So, a believer is in a relationship of communication with bodies of the church, with members of the body, right? And then that person is excommunicated. The communication is broken. So that's where the word is built. The disciples faced a theological problem. Their question, Rabbi, who sinned, this man and his parents, that he should be born blind, was based on a principle stated in the law. And this is what I quoted before. God keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. And yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generation. So that's where the rabbis get this theory. Somebody had a sin somewhere. By the way, let me stop again to make an important point. There are those who teach that all sin... There are those who teach that all illness or sickness is the result of personal sin. I've seen that taught. And one of the arguments they sometimes use is, if you get sick, think back and you'll remember you sinned before you got sick. But that's really a ridiculous argument, because we know we always sin. What about the times we sin and don't get sick? Is God being inconsistent? The reason we get sick is because we're still in fallen bodies, living in a fallen world. Right now in our congregation, we got a flu going around. It's not because anybody's sinning. These things happen. So we want to bear that in mind, that we don't want to get that mindset that if we become sick, what did I do? Did I do anything wrong? Is God upset with me? No. Now, it is possible to get sick because you sin. That is a possibility. People who get emphysema later in life because they smoke all their lives, they became sick as a result of a sin in their life, an habitual sin, not caring for the temple, God's temple. But the rule, all sickness results from sin, is really not from the Bible at all, and very, very poor teaching, especially to the newer believer. They construed this to mean that if a person suffered from any ailment, it must have been because either his parents or grandparents had sinned. To this they added the thought that perhaps he might have sinned before birth, whether as an embryo or in a pre-existent state. Such a concept appears in the rabbinical writings. So we do know that this was a concept back then. Okay, E. Yeshua rejected either alternative suggested by the disciples. In this case, a man was born blind, and here's what Yeshua says, in order that the works of God might be displayed in him. While it is true that personal sin can result in physical affliction, and we see examples of that in Scripture, like, for example, the Corinthians, right? Some of them were sick because they were disrespecting the Lord's Supper and so forth. And the sin of the parents may be visited upon the children, even to the third and fourth generations. It is also sometimes in God's plan to bring physical infirmities or suffering to the life of an individual to demonstrate the works of God. Also, remember something else. You know when it says, the verse that I just read from, where it says in Exodus, visiting the iniquity on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. If you finish reading that, I cut that off there. If you finish reading that, it says, but showing loving kindness to those who fear him. So the thing we want to remember is the chain can be broken too. That's very important. Example. You have in your life, and I have seen this, for some reason, there's some kind of spiritual believer, difficulty in your life, and it seems as though you're always under spiritual attack. It's discovered that your grandparents were involved in the occult. Their involvement in the occult can be an influencing factor in your difficulties. But the chain can be broken by becoming a believer, by fearing God, prayer, the prayer of others, following God's word. You can be delivered from this, and the chain of sin can be broken. So it's not invulnerable chain. Okay. Many great messianic leaders of the past were physically disabled, but their disabilities became the channels through which the works of God were manifested in a special way. In verses 4 and 5, and let me read them again so we have them in front of us, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. In verses 4 and 5, day means the time allotted for Yeshua to do God's will. We includes the disciples and by extension, all believers. Night is the limit set to do God's works. In Yeshua's case, it was his impending death. As the light of the world, Yeshua gives people salvation. After his death, his disciples would be his lights. Notice again we have that conflict between darkness and light. But that's what Yeshua meant when he said, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Day was that period of time during which he was doing his works on earth, and with his death came the night when he was no longer with us. But his disciples then became the light of the world. And by extension, we are the light of the world. Okay. Yeshua made clay from dust and spittle and placed it on the man's eyes. The use of clay parallels the creative act of God in Genesis 2:7. God made man from the dust of the earth. Since the blindness was congenital means from birth, the healing would be creative rather than remedial. So this was a creative act on the part of Yeshua. He wasn't fixing something. He was making something new. Okay? Everybody all right so far? Questions? Comments? Okay. I once knew a fellow who was blind in one eye when I was in college. And, you know, fortunately, better one eye than none, clearly. But it was made it very difficult for him. I remember he couldn't drive. And it was very difficult for him to get, I mean, he adapted, you know, but our eyesights were a precious, precious gift from God. Now, another thing that we want to envision here, before we move on, think about how wonderful this is now. Here's this man blind from birth, right? The scriptures say the heavens declare the glory of God. He never had an opportunity to experience that. And now all of a sudden he does. Can you imagine what his first night was like when he looked up and saw the stars? And the next day when he saw the sunrise? And when he looked out over fields of wheat and saw birds flying in the air? We take these things for granted, right? He must have walked around for the first few weeks of his life just in awe at God's creation. It must have been wonderful. Yes? Let me share an interesting story with you. Of course, I'm not blind, obviously. And I can see. I'm not bad at all. I'm nearsighted. But I remember when I was in college, I was 18 years old, and I was at Penn State, and I was in a lecture hall where instead of a smaller classroom like this, it was a really, really big room, like an auditorium. And I was sitting way towards the back, and the teacher was writing on the blackboard, and I couldn't see what he was writing. And for the first time, I was experiencing this. And I went home, and I said to my father, Dad, I couldn't see the board. My father was also nearsighted, so he said, I'm going to take it to my optometrist. And my optometrist said, you're nearsighted. We need to make glasses for you. So he did the thing and everything. And we came back the next week, and he had the glasses ready for me. And I put them on, and he tested them. They worked all right. And I had them on, and I walked out of his office. And I walked out of his office. The first thing I did is I looked up, and right about maybe where that picture was, there was a tree. And I looked at the tree, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it because for the first time, you know when children draw a tree, they sometimes draw just a brown trunk, and they draw a green circle. That's what trees had always looked like to me. They had looked like I saw the trunk, and I saw the green of the leaves, but now I could see each individual leaf for the first time. And I looked at it, and I was fascinated to see each leaf. It was so beautiful. So imagine this man born blind. Imagine him walking along and seeing a rose for the first time, or a sheep. Anything. It must have been a butterfly. What an experience. The heavens declare the glory of God. He must have just spent the first few weeks of his life walking around enjoying existence. It must have been so wonderful to him. To tell you the truth, imagine now for the first time he sees female beauty. Maybe meets a woman and gets married. He's not a beggar anymore. He can learn a trade and get married and have children. So his whole life has changed. So it's really, when you think of it, the story, there's such a tender side to this story. It's fantastic. Okay, so that takes us through verse 12. And now we're going to go from verse 12 through, we'll take it through the end of the chapter now, because that's all one part of the story. Sure.
Before we start.
Then. Sure.
The generations, the curse. I was always taught that on the cross that was broken, that there wasn't a curse anymore through the generations. that.
When you were taught that, were you given a passage of scripture to back it up?
Well, yeah, in the sense that everything was taken care of on the cross.
Yeah, but that's not a passage.
No.
Got to be careful. We need a passage. Yeah. We have to be careful with that.
So then there is generational curses? Is that what you're saying?
That's what the Bible seems to say. Visiting the sins of the grandparents and the parents onto the children to the third and fourth generations. And we see that in many ways. Alcoholism can be passed on, not only genetically, but behaviorally. Many things can be passed on. Many habitual sins can be passed on from generation to generation to generation to generation, but the chain can be broken. I would say that if you want to break a chain of sin, I can't think of a better way to do it. Yeah, all right. Good thought. Did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just have a question. You said that brought us through verse 12, and now we're on, now we start H.
Wait, let me see where we are. When we start back on the lesson, we'll be starting with H. Let me see if that's correct. Yeah, I do want to include H with 13 through 34. I see what you're saying. It looks like it might still apply to what we just covered, but it is going to start to introduce the conflict. Any other questions, comments before we continue? Okay, let's read now. Back again in verse 12, they is this crowd in the town. Bear in mind in Yeshua's day, when they talk about these towns that we're talking about, don't think in terms of Los Angeles. These were what we today might call villages. So probably everybody in the village knew this man. They were smaller back then. They brought to the Pharisees the man who was born formerly blind, which makes sense. They didn't know what sense to make of this, so what are they going to do? We'll bring him to the Pharisees. They'll give us the answer. Now, it was a Sabbath on the day when Yeshua made the clay and opened his eyes. Whoa, here we go. Then the Pharisees also were asking him again how he received his sight. And he said to them, he applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see. It's a pretty simple explanation. Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. But others were saying, how can a man who is a sinner perform such sign? And there was a division among them. See again, here we have the division. So they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. The blind man really didn't know who he was, but he just reasoned, you know, this man must be a prophet. He must, essentially what he was saying is he must be from God. The Jews then did not believe it of him that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they called parents of the very one who had received the sight. They wanted to verify this before they went further with it. They wanted to make sure that this was the truth. That this wasn't just someone who walked up and said, hey, I can see. I wasn't able to see before. And questioned them, saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? Then how does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son, and that he was born blind. That's the important information. But how he now sees, we do not know, or who opened his eyes, we do not know. Ask him, he is of age, he will speak for himself. Now, of course, you've heard many say his parents were trying to distance themselves from this, and there may be some truth from that because they were scared of the Pharisees. But it seems to me they were being pretty straightforward. They did say, this is our son. We know he was born blind. They weren't there. It doesn't say they were there when this happened. And they said, ask him. He is of age, which meant that he was an adult. Let him speak for himself. But it does say in 22, his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. So there was some fear on their part. They didn't want to get involved in this. They just wanted him to speak for himself. And I don't want to put his parents, I don't think I would want to put his parents down too much for this. Because this was, you know, imagine you're a member of a church and something comes up and the leaders of the church are very angry about something. And they ask you to witness one way or another. And you know that based on what you say, or to agree about one thing or another, what you say may cause you to be excommunicated from the church. I could see a person becoming fearful and not wanting to be excommunicated and saying, well, John was there. Talk to John. Don't talk to me. So I can understand that. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him to be the Messiah, he was to be put out of the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. So a second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. Okay? He then answered them, and this is one of my favorite statements in Scripture. He then answered them, and you know how sometimes you get the feeling when you hear somebody say something, you say, God influenced what they said just then. I think this is one of those instances. This is beautiful. Then he answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. What a beautiful statement. Because it's packed with meaning. It's packed with implication. So they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? Now, he's already been asked this question how many times now? This is like the third time he's being asked. He answered them, and he's getting frustrated with this already. So he answers them, what's the word? He answers them with a critical answer. He answered them, I told you already and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not want to become his disciples too, do you? He's getting frustrated. What do you want me to tell you? Wanted a fifth time? How many times should I repeat this? They reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. So now there's a conflict going on between the man born blind and the Pharisees. Now, of course, when they say we are disciples of Moses, basically it's a reference to the Sabbath. You're his disciple. You don't keep the Sabbath. We're disciples of Moses. We keep the Sabbath. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he is from. And again, the wisdom that this man shows, and here's a man born blind. He's never read. Didn't go to school. I really believe the Spirit of God was leading and working through this man. Listen to what he says. The man answered and said to them, well, here is an amazing thing that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. I mean, this man, here's a man born blind, think about it, spent his whole life begging, sitting by the roadside with a tin cup, and he's doing a pretty good job with the Pharisees here, with these learned men. They answered him, you were born entirely in sins, again referring to the belief that it was sin. And are you teaching us? So they put him out. They excommunicated him. Got rid of him. He's out of the synagogue. Okay, let's stop there. And as a matter of fact, that's where we're going to stop now, because it's time for our break. And when we come back from the break, we'll go through the notes on this. So go get some calories, get fat, and come back. Okay, now we're going to look at the notes referring to verses 13 through 34 in chapter 9. Yeshua's making of clay broke the rabbinic tradition against kneading clay on the Sabbath. However, the motive for the cure was compassion. Yeshua had little to gain by performing the miracle since he needed to offer no further proofs to the multitude of what he could do. Think about that. He'd already performed many miracles, so he had nothing to prove. This was not a self-serving miracle at all. You know, once I've done 15 magic tricks, I don't need to do another one to convince you I'm a magician. He did it out of compassion. Yeshua must have realized that healing this man on the Sabbath would cause an even more violent protest from the rulers than had the healing of the man at the pool earlier in his ministry. Nevertheless, he did it because of his concern for the individual. And so notice that Yeshua put his concern for the individual above his own concern. Now, it is true Yeshua knew it was not his time. But nonetheless, Yeshua did not take into consideration the possible offense and anger of the rulers and what that result might be. What he took into account was, what is the compassionate and loving thing to do? Since this miracle was so unusual, the people brought the man to the Pharisees, who were highly respected in religious matters. To the Pharisees, healing, unless life was in danger, or making or kneading clay violated the Sabbath law. So Yeshua had violated, without one healing, had violated two laws. And remember the penalty for violating the Sabbath: stoning. When the Pharisees questioned the man, he briefly told them what happened. And that's what we saw in verse 11. The man who was called Yeshua made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, "Go to Siloam and wash." And I went away and washed, and I received my sight. That's a pretty good account of what happened. The Pharisees believed that since Yeshua had violated the Sabbath law, he was not from God. However, others concluded that the signs were so impressive that a sinner could not have done them. So there's a division among the Pharisees here. The Pharisees were divided. Perhaps Nicodemus was one of the Pharisees who was favorable toward Yeshua, because he had evidenced that in the past. The question, how can a man... Wait, does this read right? The question, how can man opening words to Yeshua, "No one can do these signs unless you, that you do unless God is with him." That doesn't read right, does it? I just misquoted here. How can a something's not right. Let me check something. Oh, I wrote that poorly, but what I was doing there. Let me see something real quickly. I'm going to have to correct this in my notes. I don't want to correct in my notes right now. So let me give you an idea of what I wanted to say there. I don't know how I typed that so poorly. But you see the reference to John 3:2, going back to Nicodemus. This man came to Yeshua by night and said to him, Rabbi, we know that you have come from God as a teacher, for no one can do these signs you do unless God is with him. And then in chapter 9, we see where it says, but others were saying, how can a man who is a sinner perform such signs? See the similarity? So I wanted to point out the similarity between what Nicodemus said in chapter 3 and what is being said in chapter 9 to show the possibility, although they don't want to be dogmatic, that it may have even been Nicodemus who was saying this because the wording is so similar. But I typed it very poorly, so I'm not even going to try and correct that right now. It's just too poorly typed. What you might want to write there is something like this. Here's what I wanted to say. Here's what I wanted to say. The statement, how can a sinner perform such signs, is similar to Nicodemus' question in chapter 3, verse 2. Is similar to the statement in chapter 3, verse 2. No one can do these signs you do unless God is with him. So perhaps Nicodemus made both statements. See, that's what I want. I don't know how I typed that so poorly, but... Yeah. This is just to show my the reason that I'm saying, yeah. Very, very poorly typed. Okay, but does everybody get what I was trying to say there? Okay. K. When asked for his opinion about Yeshua, the man who had been blind said he is a prophet. Now notice something here. We're going to see a growth in this man's faith. Right now he sees Yeshua as a prophet, not as a son of God, right? And remember, one of the themes of the Gospel of Prologue is the growth of faith and the growth of unbelief and the conflict between growth and unbelief. So we're seeing that here now on the part of the Pharisees and the man, and we're going to see how it grows. Unconvinced of the genuineness of the cure, again, poor typing, the Pharisees interrogated his parents. See the typo? Okay. If he was not really born blind, the miracle could be disputed. His parents, fearing excommunication from the synagogue, evaded the issue by stating that their son was an adult capable of answering for himself. To the Jews, there was only one solution. The law forbade working on the Sabbath. Yeshua had healed on the Sabbath, therefore Yeshua was a sinner. That was their conclusion. Of course, as we've discussed before, the problem was, and I think we did discuss this, remind me if we didn't, the law, remember when Yeshua said, my Father is working until now and I am working. So when it said God rested from his work, he rested from his creative work, but not from his work of providence, of watching over, maintaining, and caring for his creation. So the commandment to not work on the Sabbath day didn't mean lay down on the floor and don't move. In fact, it didn't necessarily actually mean don't work. What it meant was don't go to your job and work. But certainly if a mule falls in a hole or if a man falls from a tree and needs to be carried somewhere to a doctor who can mend his leg, that's providential work, which God is in which God is still engaged. Yeah. Yes.
Is that not a creative work?
No, well, what he did, see, here's how he broke the Sabbath. The way he made the clay was he spit on the dirt, and then he picked it up and he made it into clay. That's what he did. And then he applied it to his eyes.
So is that not creating
eyeballs? Well, it's not creating in the sense of something from nothing. See, it's in Genesis 1:1, when it says, "In the beginning God created," the Hebrew there is something from nothing. Now, for example, God made man, right? But he didn't create man something from nothing. He made him out of the dust of the ground. So it's not the same type of creative act. And one of the questions you bring up is a good question, because there are theologians who believe that the only creative act that's ever taken place is the Genesis 1:1 something from nothing. That everything else that took place was something from something. So when God made all the animals, he took existing materials and made animals. Now we come to the question of the water made into wine. Was that a creative act? It's possible. It's also possible that Yeshua in some mysterious way gathered molecules and atoms together and put them into that water to turn them into wine. So you notice that it says, we want to be clear about this, in chapter 9, it says, where is it? Look at verse 6. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle. It doesn't say created. He made clay. See the difference? But it was breaking the Sabbath as far as the Pharisees were concerned. But it was not a creative act.
But Mark, isn't God the only one that can create?
Of course. God is the only being capable of creating something from nothing. Human beings can make something from something. We can take raw materials and build a car. But we can even put in a heart valve, in a sense. But only God has the ability, and he's the only being in the universe, including Satan, who has the ability. It's called creation ex nihilo. I think that's Latin. And that's something from nothing. Okay. Because notice it also says in Genesis, he made the stars also. It doesn't say he created them. So that probably was not a creative act. It was probably, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and here now we have all the raw material necessary for God's creation. And then God goes to work, building the creation. Okay, that's a good question, though. That's a good question. Okay. And the man's witness was clear, and he refused to deny what he knew for certain. I was blind, but now I see. They asked him to go over a story again, hoping to find the contradiction in his reports. Aha, now we have the motive. You know, it does seem strange. They keep asking them to repeat this, and it's such a simple little story. They want to find some kind of contradiction somewhere. The ex-blind man became impatient. He had already told them how he was healed in verse 15, but they did not listen to him. That is, they rejected it. He sarcastically asked if their request for him to repeat his report indicated that they had a change of heart. and were inquiring because they were interested in becoming Yeshua's disciples, which obviously the blind man knew they weren't interested in becoming his disciples. He was speaking sarcastically to them. And you know, when you think about it, what did this man have to be afraid of? He spent his whole life blind. What were they going to do to him? You know, he was a man who was prepared for suffering. He was not afraid of these Pharisees. I went my whole life blind and now I can see. I'm going to be afraid of you? There was a division.
Yeah.
There was a division among the Pharisees, no question about it. Okay. The idea of this illiterate beggar sarcastically suggesting they were interested in Yeshua was more than their pride could take. They insulted him, "You were born altogether in sin," and then claimed that whereas they were disciples of Moses, they did not even know where this Yeshua had come from. The blind man replied, "Here is an amazing thing that you do not know where he is from, yet he opened my eyes." Now this blind man is implying what? Yeshua came from heaven. This man's spiritual insight is growing. Okay. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Now picture, the common people cowered at the Pharisees. And here's this man making this bold statement to the Pharisees because the Pharisees just told him, admit that he's a sinner, and he comes right back and says, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Because the Pharisees had no argument to withstand this reasoning, they resorted to excommunication. They just said, hey, you're excommunicated. They had really no reason. Among the Jews, two types of discipline were used. The temporary exclusion, which cut off a man from fellowship until his penitence warranted restoration. That's the type of excommunication that should be exercised today in the church. And the permanent ban, which pronounced a curse on him and separated him forever from the congregation. Probably the former is meant, since here the latter would have required a formal vote of the Sanhedrin. So this probably was a temporary excommunication, but still it carried a stigma with it. It disfellowshipped him for some period of time, who knew how long. So it wasn't very pleasant. When Yeshua heard of the unfortunate result of the controversy with the Pharisee, he was moved with compassion. Now, what we're going to see here is, so far in the chapter, Yeshua has exhibited a concern for this man's physical well-being, right? Now what we're going to see is Yeshua doesn't stop there. He's also concerned about this man's spiritual well-being. So let's read. Found in verse 35, you see where it says, Yeshua heard they had put him out, and finding him, okay, implies Yeshua looked for the man so he might minister to him and confirm his faith. He didn't just bump into him again. Yeshua went looking for him and found him. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Is a call to commitment. Since the healing occurred after Yeshua's first interview, he would not have recognized Yeshua by sight. We spoke about that. Remember how the man sitting there blind, Yeshua puts the mud on his eyes and says, go wash in the pool of Siloam. The man goes and washes in the pool of Siloam and can see, but he's never seen Yeshua yet. right? So that's why the man makes the statement. He answered, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" He doesn't recognize Yeshua as the man who healed him. Otherwise, he might have answered differently. Yes?
We didn't. I don't think we read 35. And the
material. Oh, wait. Did we read 35 through?
No.
Oh, yeah. You're right. We didn't. I was wondering why I was saying things that I didn't recognize. Okay. Let's stop for just a moment. You're correct. We have to read from verses 35 through 41. Thanks for correcting me. Yeshua heard that they had put him out, and finding him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He, the blind man, answered, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" So again, we see the blind man did not recognize Yeshua because he had never seen him. Yeshua said to him, and here this is similar to what he said to the woman at the well, but look how he words it. "You have both seen him," isn't that beautiful way to put it? "And he is the one who is talking with you." Very similar to what he said to the woman at the well. But I love the way he said, "You have seen him." And he said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. He recognized the deity of the Messiah and received him into his life as Savior and worshiped him. Notice Yeshua received the worship, affirming his deity. And Yeshua said, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" Yeshua said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But since you say we see, your sin remains." Okay, now let's go back to the notes and sort this out. And I'm going to start again from S so we can pick up the flow. I'll just read it. When Yeshua heard of the unfortunate result of the controversy with the Pharisees, he was moved with compassion. Found in verse 35 implies that Yeshua looked for the man so that he might minister to him and confirm his faith. "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" is a call to commitment. Since the healing occurred after Yeshua's first interview, he would not have recognized Yeshua by sight. When Yeshua identified himself to the man, the man worshipped him. While the title Lord was used in the Brit Chadashah many times as an expression of respect, it doesn't always mean Lord God. That word, Greek word that's translated Lord, can be used just as a sign of respect. It can be used either way. Here it is clearly a title of reverence. John uses this verb exclusively to refer to the worship of God. So in the Gospel of John, John does not use it. Let's put it this way. In the Greek language, it can be used either way. John does not. He only uses it as a title of reference for Yeshua. Yeshua's remark, "For judgment I came into the world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind," makes him the pivot on which human destiny turns. The Pharisees, assuming they could see without his intervention, those who could see, and the see is really, what's the word? I keep forgetting that word, and I just used it. He's not speaking sincerely. Those who claim they can see. The Pharisees, assuming that they could see without his intervention, asked in resentment, "Are we blind too?" Yeshua's response indicated that if they acknowledged their blindness, they could be freed from sin. But if they asserted they could see while really blind, there would be no remedy to them. So let's read those verses again and make sure we get what they're saying. Yeshua said, "For judgment I came into the world, so those who do not see may see, like the man born blind. He could not see and he was made to see, but he also was made to see spiritually, wasn't he? He came into the world to give sight to the blind, most especially sight to the spiritually blind. Okay, everybody got that part of the verse? And that those who see may become blind. And what he's really saying there is those who think they can see without my intervention. And then those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, "We are not blind too, are we?" And Yeshua said to them, "If you recognize," I'm going to kind of put some meaning into this, I think. "If you recognized your blindness, then you would have no sin. Then you could be healed of that of the blindness that you have, that you recognize. But since you say we see, your sin remains." And that's true today. People who say, "I have no need for Yeshua," their blindness remains, their sin remains. But when people say, "Lord, I can't see," and that's not what they say, "Lord, I need help. I realize I can't make it on my own without your assistance," then they're recognizing their spiritual blindness, and then they can be healed and made to see. So that's what he's saying there. Okay? Any questions on chapter 9? Really one of my favorite chapters. Okay, we're going to go into chapter 10 now. Chapter 10. Let's take a breather for a minute. Excuse me? Oh, notebooks? No. Do we need one? Oh, let's see what we can do. Because I want you to have 10 in front of you. Can somebody share their 10? Because I need mine to read from. Okay, now we're going to begin chapter 10. And chapter 10 is another favorite chapter. It begins with the parable of the Good Shepherd. So let's do this. We're going to take first the first 18 verses, which are the actual parable. Okay? In fact, we may not even do that. I want to split it up into shorter segments. So let's just take the beginning. Because if we take too much at once, it's not a good idea. So I just want to take the first, say, 8 verses first. Okay? Because this is the actual introduces the parable. "Truly, truly," now there's that double amen. So we know that whatever Yeshua is going to say now is something very important and something that's a little bit difficult to believe, unless, of course, you're a person of faith. "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he puts forth all his own, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. A stranger they simply will not follow, but will flee from him because they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech, so we see that this is a figure of speech Yeshua is using, and the figure of speech is a parable. But they did not understand what those things were which he had been saying to them. So they could not interpret the figure. They couldn't take the figurative and put it into the literal. So Yeshua said to them, again, the double amen, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. Okay, let's just take those verses, because that in itself, that's the actual parable. And what comes after that is a conversation between Yeshua and those with whom he's speaking, and he still continues to speak in figurative language interspersed with literal language. So the parabolic language does still continue, but in essence, he does explain to them what he means by this. Okay, so let's go to our notes. Comparing people to a shepherd and a sheep was common in the Middle East. Kings and priests called themselves shepherds and their subjects sheep. The Bible makes frequent use of this analogy. Many of the great men of the Tanakh were shepherds: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David. As national leaders, Moses and David were both shepherds over Israel. Some of the most famous passages in the Bible employ this motif. And I have some, for example, Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." And I have some others. God is known as the shepherd of Israel in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament. Yeshua developed this analogy in several ways. The connection with the preceding chapter is seen in Yeshua's contrast of the Pharisees with the man born blind. The Pharisees, spiritually blind while claiming insight, were false shepherds. So you can see there's definitely a connection between the two chapters. As the true shepherd, Yeshua came to seek and to heal. His sheep hear his voice and respond. So you can see that Yeshua's teaching here, this parable, is not just a totally new idea from that which came before it. He's still the what happened in chapter 9 echoes into chapter 10 in a sense. Okay, one, Messiah, the Good Shepherd. And bear in mind, one of the best ways to teach, and I used to be a teacher, I think I may have shared this with you once, but when you want to teach, the best way to teach is to teach, if you want to teach some people something new that they don't know yet, is to teach from the known to the unknown. In other words, I used to be a math teacher. Now, the first thing you teach in mathematics, the first function that you teach in mathematics is addition. Once you have taught addition, the next thing you want to teach is multiplication. And the best way to teach multiplication is to teach it starting with addition. What you do is you go 1 plus 1 plus 1 is... and the class will all say 3. And then you say, so 3 ones give us, and you wait for the class to say 3. And then you write 3, and then you put down the sign here, and you say, this sign means there's 3 of them. There's 3 ones. So 3 ones give us 3. And we call the sign the times sign. So the students now learn the name of the sign. And we did, of course, now just a very, very simple example. But then you put 6 and 6 is 12. And you say if we have 2 6s is 12, so it's 2 times 6. And they get, so you see that a good way to teach is from the known to the unknown. And that's the way Yeshua taught. He's teaching them here now this parable. But notice what he's using. He's using the analogy of shepherd and sheep. That's the known. They know about shepherds and sheep. They know about sheep pens and sheep wrecking. We're going to get into this, because this is a lot of stuff they know. They knew that we don't know today. This is going to be interesting. But they knew a lot of the stuff he's going to say here, they knew about, because he was starting from the known and taking them to new stuff, to the unknown. Okay. A sheep pen was usually a rough stone or mud brick structure, only partially roofed to let some sunlight in. It had only one gated opening through which the sheep could pass when they came in for the night. The pen served for the protection of the sheep against thieves and wild beasts. A doorkeeper guarded the gate at night. A thief, who would not have any right to access by the gate, used another means of entrance. Maybe he would climb up on the roof and go through that opening in the roof. He would not follow the lawful method of approach. And Yeshua's hearers knew about all of this. So they knew when he gave them this parable, they could picture what he was saying. They understood, but they just couldn't take it into the spiritual realm. They had that same problem we see throughout John. They understand the physical realm, but they can't get up to that spiritual insight that Yeshua is trying to give them, so he has to continue teaching them and leading them upwards. Thief and robber are different meanings. Thief, kleptis, means subtlety and trickery. Robbery, lestis, connotes violence and plundering. The purpose of both was exploitation. Neither was for the welfare of the sheep. And again, think about the Pharisees. They did exploit the people. The shepherd enters by the gate, which is the lawful method of entry. Yeshua was contrasting himself with the false messiahs who, by pretense or violence, attempted to gain control of the people. There had been a number of false messiahs who came prior to him, but they didn't come. I was going to say they didn't come lawfully, but a better way to say it is they didn't come. They were not sent by God. And they came to exploit. They came to rebel against Rome, which was not God's purpose, and so forth. He came as the legitimate heir of the chosen seed and claimed to be the fulfillment of the promises of the Old Covenant revelation. Each time the word sheep is mentioned, it is in the plural. Yeshua was defending his authority as shepherd of the nation of Israel, and the sheep represented the chosen spiritual remnant of Israel discussed in the writings of Paul. Okay, everybody with me so far? Okay. Now, this is very interesting to me. A pen frequently held several flocks. Quite often, the pens were large. And quite often, at the end of the day, shepherds would come from the surrounding areas, and they'd all put the sheep all together in the pen. Now, how do you know whose sheep is whose? Well, watch. A pen frequently held several flocks, and when the time came to go out to the morning pasture, each shepherd separated his sheep from the others. Now, how did he do this? They didn't brand sheep back then. Shepherds knew their sheep well and gave them names. So that's number one. They recognized their own sheep. Even to us, all sheep might look pretty much the same. They had relationships with, they knew all the sheep. But listen to this. As the sheep heard the sound of their owner's familiar voice, they go to him. Instead of driving them, he led them, so they followed him as a unit. Wherever they went, the shepherd preceded them to provide guidance to the best pasturage and guardianship against possible danger. The sheep refused to follow a stranger because his voice was unfamiliar. In fact, if a stranger should use the shepherd's call and imitate his tone, the flock would instantly detect the difference and would scatter in panic. Isn't that fascinating? So what happened in the morning is the shepherd went to the gate of the sheep and called out with a call that he always used, and all his sheep recognized his call and came and gathered around him, and then he would lead them out. Now, suppose I heard his call and said, I know what I'll do. I'll arrive 5 minutes before him tomorrow and call. And I come and I stand there and I yell out the same exact call he did. They're going to scatter and probably run to the very back of the pen and hide. because they know their owner's voice, along with knowing his call. The point of this figure of speech consists in how a shepherd forms his flock. People come to God because he calls them. Their proper response to his call is to follow him. But this spiritual lesson was missed by those who heard Yeshua, even though they certainly knew the local shepherd-sheep relationship. In their blindness, they could not see Yeshua as Lord who is shepherd. See, they couldn't see that Yeshua was talking about himself. It's obvious to us, but we shouldn't actually put them down because we've been studying the Bible, we have a new covenant, we go to church and your pastors explain this stuff to us. So I can understand them being slightly confused by this, but when he starts speaking about the shepherd-sheep relationship, I think they should have not had all the confusion they had based on the past. It was common. The parable was a common way of teaching back then. Yes. After a shepherd's flock had been separated from the other sheep, he takes them to pasture. Near the pasture is an enclosure for the sheep. Now the shepherd becomes the gate. Let me picture this again now. Here we have this very, very large gate, right? The shepherd calls his sheep. Then he leads them out to pasture and he takes them somewhere, some ways away, to a nice pasture where they can and there's a smaller enclosure, not nearly large enough as the gate, because he only has his one little flock. So there's an enclosure there, again, with a doorway. Okay. After the shepherd's flock has been separated from the other sheep, he takes them to pasture. Near the pasture is an enclosure for the sheep. Now the shepherd becomes the gate. He's the gatekeeper now. He takes his place at the doorway or entrance of the enclosure. The word "and" should precede the word "determines." And determines who may enter the enclosure and who may not. This parallels Yeshua's later statement, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." Entering this fold is parallel to entering into the kingdom of heaven and into a relationship with the Father, and the only way to do it is to come through Yeshua, by way of Yeshua. No one comes to the Father but through me. The sheep can now go out to the pasture in front of the enclosure, or, if afraid, they can retreat to the security of the enclosure. When Yeshua said, "All who came before me were thieves and robbers," he referred to those leaders of the nation who cared not for the spiritual good of the people, but only for themselves. Yeshua the shepherd provides security for his flock from enemies. Whoever enters through me will be saved or kept safe. Okay, Kay. The thief, that is the false shepherd, cares only about feeding himself, not building up the flock. He steals sheep in order to kill them, thus destroying part of the flock. But Messiah has come to benefit the sheep. He gives the sheep life, which is abundant and overflowing with goodness. Okay? And I think that's going to be a good cutting off point because the next section is rather long and some complex teaching in it, and we've reached our end anyway. So we'll stop here. And we meet next on the 1st.
So we're going to start with verse 9.
We start with verse 9 next time.